It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you so much for joining me. Well, we felt a little bit of a north wind on Friday here in Illinois, in the Chicago area. It was certainly very refreshing, but it also reminds us that the first north wind of the year in October, believe it or not, brings birds. Because, hey, wait a minute, today is only Sunday, August 11th. What are you talking about? We're about to get into that time of the year when you want to grab a book and big lemonade or whatever and go sit by a tree and just enjoy some of the great days of summer. But for birds, the migration has already begun. It's begun with blue-winged teal, it's begun with pintail, and as absurd as that sounds, I mean, just you can't believe it, but this is what they do. And it's also beginning for a whole series of songbirds, so the next almost 4 months is a bit of a continuous migration. It's part of their life cycle. They actually birds spend less time on the breeding grounds than they do anywhere else. The breeding grounds for adult birds can be a very dangerous place, particularly if you're a female, whether you're a female warbler or a female mallard or whatever female you might be, female hen pheasant, hen quail, it doesn't really matter. The breeding grounds are a dangerous place, and for migratory birds, the arrival on the breeding grounds is for one purpose: have a mate, make a nest, hatch eggs, raise them, and leave. That's what's going on. So throughout the Illinois River Valley, the first blue-winged teal are actually showing up. Throughout the West, we're already seeing the vanguard of pintail moving south. And these birds, of course, will travel way into Central America, deep into Central America, the largest wintering population of blue-winged teal being in Nicaragua, a country I've been to several times. And I can tell you from eyewitness reports firsthand, the numbers of blue-winged teal in Nicaragua are simply stunning. So when you're sitting out on the back yard or the back deck or sitting on your boat, wherever you might be over the next couple of weeks, somewhere overhead, largely unseen, the migration is underway. And that means that fall is not that far away. And of course, in just a couple of weeks, dove season will be upon us. It just doesn't seem possible. It's gone so fast this summer. So the other thing that's happening in wildlife is what's going on in the West. And I mention this from the context of maybe it didn't have to be this way, but it is, and how are we going to deal with it? I recently spent a bit of time in the American West fishing, as I like to do every summer if I possibly can, and I was again struck by the magnitude, the enormity of the change that we have wrought on fisheries throughout the American West, particularly anadromous fish runs, steelhead, and salmon that were at one time absolutely epic and which actually continued in pretty good numbers in many places until the late 50s, early 1960s, before the last of the big dams on the Columbia and on the Snake and a host of other rivers shut the door to migrating fish. The one thing we don't talk about, which I was keenly made aware of last week, is what is the economic value that we've lost in having placed these dams, which, of course, made settlement of much of the era to make American West possible, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, but at what cost? Today, we think of Bristol Bay in Alaska as the greatest fishery on the face of the earth and ever. It wasn't. Bristol Bay is what is left of the greatest fishery on the earth. The greatest fishery on the earth in North America was the Columbian Basin, and what went up from the Columbian Basin on into the Snake River, the Columbia River, and all of its tributaries. In fact, the longest anadromous fish run in the world starts in the Columbia River and ends up in the Snake, all the way up the Salmon River into the Sawtooth Mountains of Redfish Lake, Alturas Lake, Pettit Lake, near Stanley, Idaho. This is a migration of over 800 miles. Salmon entering the Columbia River at the mouth and traveling upstream. And these fish today, the bare remnants of what once was tens of millions of fish, I think we're down in one case to like 30 sockeye salmon coming up one tributary where there used to be millions. And those 30 wild sockeye salmon have somehow made it through the dams, through the big lakes that the dams cause, where the current's lost, through the warming of water, up fish ladders, surviving predators and everything to make it to spawn. Now, they are augmented by hatchery-raised fish. But my point in asking this sort of this question is, did we ever think of the value that we would have in America to the world for fishing, commercial fishing, recreational fishing, and for the ecosystem, if we haven't dammed these rivers? All we hear is the tremendous economic benefit that these rivers brought: agriculture, shipping, transportation. And yes, the damming of these rivers provided for water for urban growth. But when you strip back the onion a little bit, all the agricultural products are subsidized by us, the taxpayers. All the transportation is subsidized by us, the taxpayers. And in many cases, the transportation promised with the damming of these rivers and the Columbia Corridor has never reached its potential. Yes, certainly the urban areas have benefited and been able to grow, but they probably could have grown in some other ways. The American West would not have the agriculture that it has if we hadn't dammed these rivers. But the American West would have the world's greatest fishery, as it did have. Salmon, steelhead, trout, sturgeon, in commercially harvestable numbers of a magnitude that far outpaces Alaska, the ecosystem much bigger than Alaska. So we're never turning back the clock entirely, but dams are definitely coming out across the American West. It's already started in some rivers. You know, are we going to take out the big dams, the dams that are completely blocking fish passage, causing big reservoirs, which are great for recreation and lousy for migratory fish? I don't know if that's going to happen, but last week I was just reminded what we've actually lost that won't come back. But if we do take some dams out, we do know the fish will come back. Those that are left, they'll find a way. That's happening across a few streams. The fish are being, dams are being removed from now. But overall, on the scale that's needed, it's not going to happen. So what we have today is really the future, which is just an absolute pittance of what once was there. And in fact, in many streams, the salmon and steelhead runs are gone, extinct. But we never thought about what the value of those fish would have been. Instead, we were an agriculturally focused economy. When these dams went in, it was all about expanding agriculture, selling equipment, farming land. Nothing wrong with that. But if we had the wisdom of today and had some foresight, we might have paused and said, wait a minute. We are talking about a fishing industry that can be worth tens of billions of dollars, an industry that is not subsidized by the American government, but exists there because nature put it there, just like the Bristol Bay, Alaska fishery exists. We didn't make those decisions. I don't even know if those discussions were even on the table. None of us were around when those decisions were made to build these enormous dams that provided hydropower and everything else. But there certainly has been a cost. In today's world, with everything we're trying to do to make our environment a better place, we should think about some of these costs before we take on enormous projects, particularly such as taking place in China right now with the building of dams on the Yangtze River and other places. There are long-term, irreplaceable consequences, and the American West is showing just how severe those consequences can be. And we're not going to get it back. We may make a little progress, but we're never returning to hundreds of millions of salmon and the fishing that they brought for the well-being of what today could feed much of the world. I'll be back in just a moment, and when I come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about warming waters and water diversion, something we don't talk about in the Midwest, but it is a real issue in certain parts of the West. So I'll be back in just a moment. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN, and first a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter here on WGN Radio. Thanks for being with me. I mentioned before the break, I just was going to take one more minute on the West before bringing things actually down to the Texas Gulf Coast. Montana is in the epicenter of what is a conflict between agriculture and fish. And it's only getting worse as more and more people come to Montana. It is indicative of what's happening across the American West, but really Montana is the bullseye for it. And that is the diversion of water through water rights to grow alfalfa and the warming up of iconic rivers as a result of that diversion. And the fact that, yes, it has been undeniably warmer earlier in the American West. So Montana for several years has put into place something called the hoot owl regulation, which means after 2 p.m. and they can move it up earlier if they want, you can't fish on certain rivers in Montana because the water becomes too warm. The oxygenation the fish need to be able to live is difficult. And then you catch a fish and it fights and it's stressed and it actually does not do very well after it's been released because it's used all of its energy with low oxygen, and the fish, the death rate from fish is very high. So Montana has gone to the hoot owl, which stops you from fishing at 2 o'clock. So the water has a chance to, during its heat of the day, not have fishing pressure, and then it cools down overnight. But that is a near-term solution to a very long-term problem, which is how is the amount of water being diverted from rivers in the American West, in this case of Montana, almost entirely for alfalfa, how is that going to be reduced to meet the needs not only of fish, but also of the hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are moving to the American West? And some of you might say, well, you know, the farmer was there first. The rules in the West are first in use, first in time, which means if you use that water before somebody else did, you have a water right ahead of them. But the world does change. And as you're going to hear more about in the coming weeks and months, Salt Lake, there's been a lot written about it. I don't want to go into that, but you're going to hear more about the coming of an iconic IMAX movie, Secrets of Great Salt Lake, which is going to draw attention to the absolute majesty of the Great Salt Lake and why it needs to be saved. And it's all part of this broader discussion that we have not had in the Midwest because we frankly have very abundant water, we think. But we also have treaties with Canada, which limit the amount of water that can come out of the Great Lakes. And there are suburbs and residential areas in the Chicago area that actually don't have enough water because we can't take more water from Lake Michigan. So it's a very complicated issue. But in the American West right now is reaching the boiling point, reaching the point where fish can't live because too much cold water is being diverted to grow alfalfa. So therefore, there's less water in the streams. Therefore, the streams heat up faster. The fishing industry in Montana is enormous. The problem in part is many people who fish in Montana don't vote in Montana. They don't live there. So it's a little bit of the old guard versus the new arrivals. And I certainly, and many of us, understand those conflicts. But time has changed. And I would offer here on the Great Outdoors Show that we're not that far away from revisiting what have been very long-term water right legal issues across much of America that no longer suit a population here in the 21st century as our needs have changed. It's not going to bring back the salmon, as I talked about of the Pacific Northwest and the great salmon runs and steelhead runs of so many rivers in the American West, the dams killed those. But in the case of Wyoming, Utah, Montana especially, Idaho, and other Western states, there is going to be something done about the use of water rights to ensure that all elements of the ecosystem, including us humans, can survive. And if we don't take that third or fourth cutting of alfalfa, how detrimental is that going to be to the overall economy? I'm not sure. But the answer is, it is changing in the American West, and we have to begin to recognize that we have been taking too much water at the wrong times of the year. Next subject I'm going to talk about is that the Fish and Wildlife Service is expanding the use on its refuge system across America. This is actually very big news and very good news. This administration, it's neither a pro or a con comment, but they have not been overly aggressive in expanding use of public lands. But the National Shooting Sports Foundation just announced that the Fish and Wildlife Service has expanded hunting and fishing on the National Wildlife Refuges. 53 new refuges will be open across 211,000 acres on 12 National Wildlife Refuges, will be added to the other 400 National Wildlife Refuges that already permit some form of hunting. That's great news as we struggle to find more and more places for individuals to hunt who may not own property. And after all, at the end of the day, if we don't have access to hunting and fishing in America, we're not going to have much support for wildlife management. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next Sunday morning with much more in the great outdoors. Have a great and safe week in the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter, your host on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.